You know, the glamour gals has stopped glamorizing. They're working in defense plants, wearing slacks. And some of the fine chicks is cutting out every day, joining the waves and the spas and the wax. Now, fellas, you can't get that no more. Mm-mm. I'm telling you, fellas, you just can't get it. You can't jive these girls like you used to do, 'cause some of them is making more money than you. I'm telling you, boys, you just can't get that no more. No, you can't get that no more. You know, the girls used to wake up every morning and say, Lord, send me a handsome man, one that's physically fit. But Uncle Sam has got all of them now, and the gals has got to take just what they can get. Mm-mm, girls, you can't get that no more. Ain't no need of giggling, girls, you just can't get it no more, that's all. Girls, you can't be particular. You got to take what's left. Either them worn out 3As or them beat up 4Fs, that's all. You just can't get it no more. No.
Think of your children pledging allegiance to the maple leaf. Mayonnaise on everything. Winter, 11 months of the year. Anne Murray, all day, every day.
CJUM FM 101.5, running on 100% Canadian volunteer power.
Presents 52nd Street Jazz for Sunday nights. Thank you.
We'll be right back. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to 52nd Street, Winnipeg's home of classic jazz. My name is Jay. For the next hour, I'll be your host right here on 101.5 UMFM. And tonight, we have what many consider to be one of the top live jazz recordings for our summer concert series. It's called Miles Davis, Cooking at the Plugged Nickel.
And that was what we're going to play tonight, but instead, I'm here.
You're listening to CJUMFM 101.5, certified and secured by the bomb-sniffing dog.
Probably not, but hey, welcome to 52nd Street, Winnipeg's home of classic jazz, and we started off, I'm running a little bit late tonight, we started off with a song that I just couldn't kill, because tonight we're going to do a tribute to Miles Davis. This week marks Miles Davis' 100th birthday. So, I am going to do the impossible for you. We started off tonight with, by the way, just in case you're wondering, a lot of people were, Miles Davis live at the Plugged Nickel, If I Were a Bell. But now we are running out of time. So, I'm going to do Miles Davis' career, or the big parts of his career at least, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 songs. Ready? Here we go. And if you're a Miles Davis fan, don't hate me for this. Miles Dewey Davis, born on May 26th, 1926, in Elton, Illinois. He was raised on a cattle farm. His father was one of the largest cattle farmers in Illinois, just 15 miles north of St. Louis. And then the family moved to East St. Louis. His father was a dentist. And so Miles grew up in a very affluent way. When he was in high school, after having started trumpet at the age of 12, he quickly became recognized, was working with local bands, was given the opportunity to travel across the country. His mother insisted that he get his education, so he stayed. In his last year of high school, there was a band that came through that included people like, but not limited to, Art Blakey, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker. Billy Eckstein's band is the name of the band. He performed with them for 2 weeks and decided he had to go to New York. So in September of 1944, he went to Juilliard to study music. He only stayed 3 semesters and then he dropped out because he wanted to play and record. One of his first big breakthroughs, not his first recording, but his first big breakthrough was joining Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker had, of course, been an idol to Davis. In fact, even years later, he'd said that Charlie Parker was one of the 4 most important figures in jazz. Here's the interesting thing. I've had a recent breakthrough I'm going to share with you, and you can disagree with me if you want. But when I first listened to Miles Davis playing with Charlie Parker, I didn't like it. I didn't get it. And because Miles Davis doesn't play bop, he plays Miles Davis. And then one day I was listening to it, and I kind of got it, what I think it's supposed to be. I think the reason Charlie Parker liked Miles Davis, well, there's a bunch of reasons. Number one is I think he could see the direction he was going and he could understand what he was doing. But I also think the reason is because what we often overlook is how melodic a player Charlie Parker is and how much he wants to tell a story. And I think he thought Miles Davis was very much telling the story. So, joined Charlie Parker's band in 1945. Which is a pretty good place to land when you think about it. They recorded together on and off. He actually left, joined Billy Eckstein's band again in 1946 and 47, and then rejoined Charlie Parker and Max Roach. So kind of bounced around for a bit. So here we're going to hear a recording from 1948, so the very first seminal part of Miles Davis' career, when he's playing with Charlie Parker on 52nd Street, as we do a quick, very quick tribute to Miles Davis' 100th birthday. Miles Davis in 5 songs. Here is Bird of Paradise, Miles Davis along with Charlie Parker. Thank you. pretty, isn't it? Actually, I have to tell you that, believe it or not, that's one of my favorite Charlie Parker songs. And I think it's just for the reason I talked about. That search for melody, that search for sound, that search for harmony that both of them were looking for at the time. So as I said, played around New York for quite a bit. And then 1948, he actually was given an offer to join Duke Ellington's band. And I think Ellington heard the same thing. A young composer, somebody who was looking for the idea to create a new voice in music and new ideas. And so what you're going to hear tonight is, we're doing Miles Davis in five songs, in case you just joined us as he turns 100 this week. Miles Davis, and the reason he becomes so seminal isn't because he's a better player than a lot. Technically, he's probably not. But it's the harmony, it's the melody, it's the lyricism of his playing. But more importantly, it's that constant desire to do something new. So he declines an offer to play with Duke Ellington, and he goes into the, well, eventually to the studio, but he starts recording with a nine-piece band. And it's during this time that he meets arranger Gil Evans, but he also plays with Jerry Mulligan and puts together a nonette. And he includes instruments such as the French horn, the tuba, and there's an orchestral sound to it, but the intent is actually to imitate the human voice, as one does with their compositions. And so in 1948, December of 1948, and 1949, they record The Birth of the Cool. And this is an album that absolutely changes the sound of jazz for, well, years to come, but absolutely changes the trajectory of jazz. And so cool is often seen as the antithesis to bop. In many ways, that's true, because it goes from frenetic to calm, from fast-paced energy to a low, relaxed kind of approach. But the reality is that the harmonies and the orchestrations have a remarkable amount of similarity. And so in many ways, it is taking what he knew and turning it into something very different, but very much someone in search of his own voice. So we're going to play The Birth of the Cool, which is probably the first of the seminal albums that Miles Davis made that changes the history of jazz forever. Let's pick a random one, shall we? Let's do this one. From 1949, here is the studio version of Boplicity right here on 52nd Street. Isn't that pretty? Which one do we play? Publicity from the album The Birth of the Cool, 1949, an album that would forever change the face of jazz and launch what we often now call the West Coast jazz style. The 1950s were an interesting time. Davis became a national icon in 1949. He actually ended up touring Europe and going to Paris as part of Paris International Jazz Show, and that changed his life forever. And he came back from Paris and fell into sort of a very difficult time. Paris changed his life because he felt that people of color and the musicians were treated a lot better, and he also began an affair with singer and actress Juliette Gréco during that time. When he returns, there's not a lot of work for him. The music scene starts to change. He starts to fall behind his rent. His wife at the time has a second child, but more importantly, he turns to heroin. And things really go from bad to worse. He gets arrested, actually, for possession of heroin. And he, in his own words, said he lost his sense of control over his life and started to drift. So he tours a little bit. He gets arrested in Los Angeles for possession of heroin, which, of course, at that time was terrible for your work because people wouldn't hire you. And then at some point, things started to turn around. He signs a contract with Prestige. Bob Weinstock became a fan of his and brought him in. And he starts to record again. And more importantly, he eventually overcomes his addiction. 1953, things had gotten really bad, so he returns to St. Louis. In his words, he stays in the room above the garage of his parents' house and kicks the habit and never touches it again. In the mid-1950s, despite the fact things are going slowly, he starts to accumulate some different ideas and some different sounds, and listening to a group of people from all different parts of the U.S. and making new friendships. And the consequence of this is he really emerges as a slightly different player. One of the things that changes him during this time was a pianist, Ahmad Jamal, who we played on the show and many of you know. And that influence becomes very important because he really appreciated the use of space and that approach, and that influenced him greatly. And so he starts to record again more significantly in the mid-1950s. And it's during this time that he accumulates a new band, the Classic Quintet, which is, of course, Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums, and a young but very talented John Coltrane on the tenor saxophone. And with this Classic Quintet, he gets signed to a new record company, a new contract, and records in 1956, excuse me, the labels, the four LPs that became just, they're must-owns if you're a Miles Davis fan. Actually, if you're just a jazz fan, they're really great albums. They are Cookin', they're all with the Miles Davis Quintet, Cookin', Relaxin', Workin', and Steaming. And this is a new sound for Miles Davis, a new band and a new sound. And these are the albums that really launch him and John Coltrane's career as well back into the national spotlight and back into being someone significant. So it's interesting because we think of Miles Davis as having this continuous impact on jazz and this continuous career, but he actually hit this kind of lull in the early 1950s that very much changed his career and changed his trajectory. And lucky for us, he recovers and records some wonderful, wonderful tracks. So we're going to listen to... let's do this one. You know what? I was going to play something else for you, but I actually can't resist one. If you want to get a sense of what this quintet was, and if you want to get a sense of how they sound, let's listen to this, because nothing tells you about a player like a ballad. From the 1956 album Steamin' with the Miles Davis Quintet, here is When I Fall in Love. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing? So during this time, Davis has a great group with him, and you can hear from that rhythm section just how strong that group is. And really reinvigorates his career. He reunites with Gil Evans, and they record a number of albums, including Sketches of Spain by Porgy and Bess and others. But in 1959, he also makes the album that would, for many, I think, define his career. It's the number one best-selling album in jazz history, if you don't count Kenny G or Norah Jones, and it's five times platinum. But it's also an interesting album because it returns what they call modal jazz, which is to say it returns to a scales-based rather than a chord-based improvisational pattern. And in doing that, returns to a very significant history of what early jazz was in a very different way. The album, of course, is Kind of Blue, and it's recorded in March and April of 1959. He says he named it for its mood, and in fact, a lot of the album has to do with the idea of color. Blue, of course. Traditionally, yellow had been a very brassy sound. Red, of course, hot. If you think of bebop, that would be red. If you think of blue, that would be cool, or blues, depending on how you want to look at it. And so we're going to hear a song now called Blue and Green. Here's what's interesting about this album. Of the album's compositions, only So What and All Blues had been played at performances. The rest of them were actually compositions that the band saw in the studio for the first time. So we just heard the lineup of John Coltrane, tenor saxophone, Wynton Kelly on piano this time. Bill Evans replaces him for one album, but Wynton Kelly on piano. Paul Chambers, Jimmy Cobb on drums, and Julian Cannibal Adderley joins with Miles Davis. Here is Blue and Green, and see if you can hear the green from 1959. Album Kind of Blue. There is truly nothing more I can say about that album or that song, but I will say this. Depending on the day, Blue and Green is my favorite track off of that album. Following the release of Blue and Green, sorry, Kind of Blue, he actually toured most of the U.S. And as a consequence really regained a following again. In the early 1960s, he reformed what they call the Second Classic Quintet. This one featuring Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins, Wynton Kelly, Paul Chambers, and Jimmy Cobb. Rollins then leaves. George Coleman comes back in. Brian Carter replaces Paul Chambers on the bass. And eventually, in 1963, they're replaced by Herbie Hancock, a 23-year-old Herbie Hancock, and the 17-year-old drummer in May of 1963 replaces Jimmy Cobb, and his name is Tony Williams. Can you imagine being 17? Anyway, and this is really an invigorating time for Davis. He records a number of albums, Seven Steps to Heaven, some of you may know from this time, Miles Davis in Europe, the live recording. And they actually also did the, in 1965, the Live at the Plug Nickel, which is actually the song that started off our whole show tonight. So you actually had a chance to hear that group, a very abstract group in some ways, very avant-garde group in some ways, an incredibly talented musical group. And so we've heard that group already. That was If I Were a Bell earlier in the show tonight. And then from 1966 to 68, he releases a number of other albums, including Miles Smiles, Sorcerer, Nefertiti, Miles in the Sky, and the list goes on. And it's an incredibly productive period. It's just during this time he starts to record songs by Wayne Shorter as well, and other sidemen. And so it's just a time of exploration and expansion. Ultimately, what it leads to is the electric period. 1968 to 1975 is characterized for Miles Davis as the electric period. And it is a time when he openly says, I want to make as much money and I want to have as much recognition as rock musicians, which you can kind of understand. And so in 1970, he records the double album, Bitches Brew, including Jack DeJohnette, Harvey Brooks, and Benny Maupin. We're going to hear from that one right now in a song called John McLaughlin, right here on 52nd Street. We'll be right back. Yeah, I never know how people react to that one. It's such a step forward. You know, it's interesting. That album sold 500,000 copies, and of course, Weather Report with Wayne Shorter was a phenomenal band that used to actually pack stadiums. Davis took a hiatus from 1975 to 1980, where he struggled with alcohol and drugs, cocaine in this case, really took him out of the music scene for a while. He tried to come back. There's some legal issues. And finally, in 1980, he actually launched what we'll call a resurgence in his career. From 1980 to 1985, he worked with a number of great musicians, including Marcus Miller. And then in 1986 to 1991, he continued to record and perform around the world until his death in 1991. At the time of his death, he was 65 years old. He had a stroke, pneumonia, respiratory failure. The list goes on. And so very, very poor health. And so it's interesting because we look back at Miles Davis now and talk about the sort of seminal history, this pillar in the jazz world. But what we can't forget and what we shouldn't forget is, like most musicians who are in the jazz world, there was a lot of personal struggles along the way, and that it wasn't 50 years of being on top of the world and changing the jazz world. It was struggles and it was fights and it was people putting their faith in him and having the ability to listen to him make the changes that he wanted to change in the music. Regardless of where you fall on him, and there's a lot of people who fall on different sides of him. He has a sort of evil genius persona, and he himself said that he'd become bitter and cynical because of the racism that he had faced. But he leaves behind an incredible musical legacy. And regardless of where you fall on some of these